And quick, this is a pod, this is a podcast, right? We're not videoing or whatever.
No, it's not videoing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So
I should have shaved then or put something nice on.
It looked great. Welcome to Live from America podcast. This is Hatem, along with Mr. Norm Dorman, the owner of the Comedy Cellar, the very funny Mr. Lou Perez from We the Internet.
Perez.
That's what I said. Actually, okay. My accent is better because that's how you say it. Perez.
Perez.
Yeah, that's how you say it. And our guest of honor, we finally got him. I've been looking to get this guy for a long time. This is going to be a great episode, I promise you. He's a Mr. John Cypher. He's a former CIA agent and intelligence expert. He was based in Moscow for some time and oversaw the operation against the Russian intelligence. He's also an advisor and actually in a couple of episodes of the hit show Spy Wars with Damian Lewis. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to be here.
Oh, that's great. This is my favorite subject, spies, or I like to call them Jews. Anyway, so I have a lot of questions. First, how did the spy war, game evolve from like before to now? Do we even use humans as spies anymore, or is it technology?
Well, yeah, I mean, most of the states for a long time have had what we call human, which is, you know, human spying, espionage, you know, betrayal and trust between people that have access to secrets. But then, you know, for a long time, they've also had what we call SIGINT, which was, you know, electronic signals intelligence, you know, in World War II, obviously breaking the Japanese code and some of the Nazi code and that type of thing. And to this day, I think most large countries and their intelligence services, probably the majority of their intelligence is from like what our NSA does, signals intelligence and telephones and into computers now, cyber, and as well as satellites and things. And so, you know, as long as people, leaders of countries believe they need more information to make better policy or to protect themselves, they're gonna look for a leg up, and spying gives a leg up, or at least that's what all leaders to this point have thought.
John, can you ever, I'm just wondering, how do you leave or retire from the CIA? Okay? It's like right now I'm looking at you and I'm like, there's no way this guy's retired. Like he's filming all this. He's getting all this information from my computer.
Wait a minute. He wanted to do this while I'm on. I know what you're up to, John. Trying to get some information on me.
Yeah, well, I got to know what I'm going after then. What is it I can get from you guys? No, retiring's pretty easy. You just say I'm retiring and leave. In fact, but I was undercover, so I was in what was our clandestine service, the espionage service, the overseas thing. But, you know, even in the CIA, there's a large analytical service that mostly stays in Washington, and as well as science and technology people. So when we retire, you know, we have a choice to stay under the cover we had, pretending to be whatever we were, State Department people or Army or whatever, or what we call roll back our cover. And I chose to do that. So since I wasn't going to do any, a lot of people come back and do contract work and stuff for CIA or intelligence community. I didn't want to do that. And so I rolled back my cover so I can tell the world that I work for CIA. But if I write things or I put together things for Hollywood or whatever, I have to run them through CIA to make sure I don't give up. I'm not giving up classified information.
And while you were undercover, did your family know?
Yes, they did. But well, my wife did and my parents did, but it's, you know, it's actually an individual choice when to tell people in your family. And mostly that has to do with your kids, because at some point you're actually putting them under quite a bit of pressure to keep a secret if they're really young, or if you're living overseas and, you know, they make a mistake and actually can jeopardize your security or the family's security. So, you know, almost every clandestine operative has a story about when and how they briefed their children or brought their children in to make them what we call witting. In fact, I have a company now that works with Hollywood on making, you know, espionage related content. And we have a show with Apple called the Witting, about making kids show, about making kids witting.
I can't imagine like being on the playground and having like as a kid and having an argument with your son or daughter about whose dad would beat up whose dad. And then they come out and they're like, no, my dad's CIA. Your dad's toast. Like he's done just like that.
I would imagine a lot of spies undercover find clever ways to get themselves in a situation where they have no choice but to have sex in order to keep their cover.
Yeah, you know, you see those movies where these beautiful sirens come after these guys, and unfortunately it didn't work that way for me. Either I was screwing it up or something didn't work, right?
You seem like a handsome guy.
You see, for me, I would never be able to keep a secret, you know.
Why is that?
Like, I would just say I'm a CIA, because it's cool, you know. I wear a jacket, say CIA, you know. Yeah.
You would be better in the FBI then. That's what they love. They love wearing all their stuff with big FBI.
Oh, yeah. So you know, there's that. We want to send, like, being a spy, because all our information from, like, movies and stuff like that, you know, versus right. the real world, you know. So do you, you know, can you tell us a little bit about, like, do you have to be cool and, like, first, who makes better spy, men or women? Because I would imagine women will be.
Interesting. So, well, it depends. So women oftentimes make better spies for a simple reason that a lot of men are misogynists overseas. So I remember in Russia, for example, the Russians are such pigs. They don't have any women that work in their security service as officers. And so, you know, they would track us and follow us and try to see what we're up to. But oftentimes the women, young women, they would just assume that they couldn't be that serious, and they would lay off of them. And, you know, so many of our best stuff that we do in places like Russia are actually, you know, women officers, you know, and because in a lot of places, you know, as they traverse and go on the streets, people don't pay attention to them as much. You know, if they see you or me walking down the street, someone might think, "Oh, they're up to something," and keep an eye on us.
Whereas, especially him.
That's yeah, what they, especially that's what they do with me right here in New York. It's like, keep an eye.
Again, the FBI.
So, without going to, you know, you probably whatever specifics you can't go into, but if we had no spies for the last 10 years, how would the world look different to us? What would be different?
That's a really good question. I don't know, because essentially the one thing, you know, you joke about it and it's cool and stuff, but really spying at the end of the day should be just really on the margin. It should be a value add. It should essentially be, you know, occasionally when we have success and can find some extra information that can help make better policy, we do so. So I would argue now under the Trump administration, he doesn't actually care about anything other than his own ideas or whatever they are. And he's not interested in actually learning more or getting up, figuring out what's happening to make better policy. It's all about him. So I don't know that intelligence is benefiting us as it might have done in the past. Since 9/11, there's been a lot of success about stopping terrorism and capturing terrorists and uncovering plots and stuff. So I like to think that there's people alive today because we did our work. But I don't want to overhype intelligence. You know, there's an incredible amount of people out there, diplomats, military officers, experts, academics, and others that are collecting information and doing things for the country. You know, we're just trying to find that extra stuff, you know, that we can't get any other way. So if the Iranians are hiding their nuclear program, you know, all the sort of experts and diplomats in the world aren't going to find anything. And so you have to actually steal what they have if we're going to learn about it.
I know the CIA operates outside, but do you actually also spy inside, like in certain, you know?
Well, if you use the word spy, it makes it hard. So yes, we operate inside. We have places in the United States, but we work with the FBI to find people in the United States that might be going back overseas if there's an Iranian nuclear student or something. Or secondly, there's a lot of, you know, amazing amount of our companies are global and therefore have access to things that they can help us with. But that's all done voluntarily. Like, unlike the FBI or law enforcement, we can't go in and compel anyone to work for us or to help us. You know, CIA is a foreign intelligence agency, so we can't go to a company and say, mid-level guy, and say, "Hey, you need to help us." But we can go to the CEO of the company and tell them what we do and ask for help. And if they're willing to help, that's great.
Did you recruit anybody from, if you can talk about that?
Recruit people from where?
From anywhere else, anywhere around the world.
Yes, in fact, yeah, you have to. That's your, you know, at the end of the day, we're a bureaucracy, and the way you move up in your junior ranks is essentially by recruiting and securely running spies. And so
how do you recruit?
If you don't recruit.
Like, if you're recruiting me right now, I mean, normally just have to tell them money, you know, but.
Yeah, well, do you guys have a booker, the way that the comedy clubs have a booker?
Well, actually, a good idea. That would be a good. So there's sort of a career thing called targeting. So in the old days, essentially you try to figure out what you didn't know, what did you need to know, what kind of people had access to that information, and we would look for ways to get in touch with a number of those people. And since most people overseas don't want to spy or spy against their country or their organization, it was, you know, it was hard work. You'd meet people, you'd assess them, you'd figure out what makes them tick. Are they potentially willing to work for us and help us or not? And most aren't, and then you move on to the next. Now there's so much data out there, you can actually do a little bit more professional, what we call targeting or finding people. So if you know there's someone, again, I'll make this up, an Iranian nuclear scientist who is the specialist on this one piece of thing that we don't understand and need to know about, you can get out in the world and see what's in their social media feed, who they're in touch with, where they went to school, what kind of things they like, don't like, what pictures of their family. So you're better armed when in fact you do meet that person to be more attractive to them or be able to build that relationship and or maybe figure out what it is that you might be able to offer that helps them. So unlike diplomats and stuff, we can pay people. So, you know, so if I was trying to recruit you, if you had something that the U.S. government believed it needed, it couldn't get any other way. It's important. If we can get it some other way.
How much are we talking?
How much? I would try to meet you and learn about you and talk to you. I'd try to befriend you so you had some level of trust in me. And in that process, I would be assessing you and developing a relationship with you to try to figure out what it is that might work for you. Maybe you have a kid who needs medical help and your government has been unhelpful. You know, I know cases, for example, where their kids needed medical help, but their bosses in their ministry or whatever had actually stolen the insurance money, so their kids couldn't get medical help. Well, I can, if I get enough of a relationship with you, offer that help in return for working and helping me.
Would you use threats?
No.
If someone is gay, like we saw that in Homeland, someone is gay, they use it against them in the Middle East. Would you do that?
No, we don't use threats, and it's not because we're wonderful people, but it's because it's actually a poor way of doing business. Our goal is to recruit people to spy for us and do it for a long period of time, because if they're in position to help us for a long time, they can move up through the ranks and be important. And if you blackmail people or threaten people, they're going to look for their first opportunity to get out, or they're going to look for an opportunity to screw you. So you'll never know when they start lying to you, or you never know when they will, you know, turn on you. So it's just bad business. It doesn't work. I mean, if it worked, maybe we would, in certain cases with terrorists, maybe.
Do you think that one country has people more likely to turn than another? Like, you think it's easier or harder to get an American to be a traitor to his country than an Iranian, or vice versa? Is everybody just the same cruddy human nature?
Well, yeah, I think it is easier, but it's not because of cultural or ethnic issues. It has to do really with your relationship with your government or with your leadership. And so, you know, there's a lot of places in the world where the corruption of the leadership is such that, and a lot of times, you know, people work for their country and they go for a while, and at some point they realize that the system is rotten. And sometimes people, you know, realize that personally. And we want to be in a position when they come to those conclusions that we're at least in a position to be able to talk to them. And so, yeah, I mean, if you're in Iran, if you're in Russia, you're in China, yeah, you know, you may be very proud of your country, but you may realize that your government is actually hurting your country or keeping your people down or what have you. And that's the thing. I mean, we would not be as successful if we were working for another country. For most of my career, despite its faults and problems and screwing things up, people respected the United States and saw it as something that, you know, for the most part was trying to do good in the world. And therefore, it was a place that if they needed help or if they didn't trust their government, they would be willing to help and trust us. That's why I worry now with this administration is we're becoming, you know, this, we are starting to look corrupt. We are starting to look like we don't give a damn. We're starting to look like we're venal and nasty. And that makes it, it would make it harder for someone to feel now to, you know, to look better and make yourself someone that another country or another person would want to step up and ask for help from.
Yeah. How much damage did people like Snowden and Manning do, would you say? And what accounts for them turning as they did?
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody turning has their own reason. And you know, that's part of the, you know, our business is to look for people that will turn and help us. And again, you want them to be squared away enough about why they're doing it so that they can stay in place. Yes, if somebody wants to sort of defect and come out and bring the stuff, that, you know, we will facilitate that, but it's much better if they stay in place and help us over time. So how much damage they do? I think Manning did damage in the sense that he gave away like 85,000 State Department reports. Now, those weren't all highly classified, but it embarrassed us around the world. So there was a lot of internal reporting from our diplomats that would report about their meetings with the president and the foreign minister, and sometimes would say negative things about them, or report to Washington about, you know, sort of silliness that they were up to. And so when that became published, that hurt our relationship with those people, with those countries. And there's some countries that, you know, any contact with an American is seen as traitorous. And so when it was shown in black and white, those people would get wrapped up or get in trouble. And so that was damaging, but not, you know, so horrible. Snowden, on the other hand, you know, a lot of people, when they think about it, think about the NSA program to look at phone data records about him. And I think in general, that debate around that has actually been okay, but he stole 2 million documents, so he could have taken that program in a 2-page description of what it was, but he took another 1,800,000 documents along with it. And so it's hard to even characterize how much that is. I mean, I would bet to say that every American would have paid several thousand dollars in taxes to the programs that were involved and got lost because of the stuff that Snowden put out. Huge amounts of, you know, money of things we've got into, underground satellite things to try to understand what's happening in these countries that had to be changed or lost because of what he passed.
Wow. That's a tremendous way of characterizing it. Every American paid thousands of dollars.
So with those two examples, it seems like now I think it's Chelsea Manning now, and then Edward Snowden. When they came out as whistleblowers, there wasn't money exchanged, right? They didn't do it, and they would receive money. They did it, I guess, because it was on their conscience. So I'm wondering, how does the CIA look at the difference between, say, a whistleblower who's actually blowing the whistle on, you know, corruption or illegal activity within the state, as opposed to just getting this information, just someone who's just putting information out that might be detrimental to state operations?
Well, I mean, that's why, you know, as painful it can be, we have to support whistleblowing statutes and support for whistleblowers. Yeah, the whistleblower, apparently, you know, according to reporting, worked for the CIA that whistleblew about the Ukrainian thing for President Trump that led to his, being impeached. And so you need to have ability for people to look up waste, fraud, and abuse and things to be able to report it, and to be able to go to Congress, to be able to go to the intelligence committees and say things. And over the years, we've learned a lot of things, you know, from whistleblowers, to include everything from sort of torture stuff to programs that have been debated after that. So you need to have that. That's important. Stealing stuff and sort of making your own decision. Everybody can't make a decision of what they think is best for the country. Otherwise we have chaos and nothing works. And we do rely on secrecy. And I spent 30 years inside. I see myself as pretty liberal, sort of, you know, normal people. I think most people in there take the work very seriously, but they don't. No one is trying to do anything that's awful or evil. And if anything is corrupt or criminal, they should be held accountable and arrested. And so, you know, almost every single area in CIA and intelligence community now is, in fact, probably, you know, maybe too much so, is filled with lawyers to look at, make sure that what we're doing is completely legal, is completely pushed through with the law, and that we're following, you know, ethical, moral, and legal guidelines on things. And so,
but is that fair?
Because you guys deal
internationally. The other teams don't play the same game. So is that fair for us to do that?
I think it helps us. I think the fact that we're seen as a place that holds people accountable and follow rule of law is the kind of things that makes people in those countries that don't have that come to us. So I think the fact that we're seen as, you know, we're willing to deal with our problems and you know, hold people accountable and hold programs accountable and follow the rule of law. That's a benefit to the United States. That's the kind of thing that I think that helps us. It helps someone like me recruit people overseas because they believe that, you know, we've created a system that does that. And so early on after World War II, when CIA first started in 1947, that view was very strong. It was like, hey, the Soviets will do anything. You know, they created a, you know, intelligence security service about mass terror, about keeping people inside the country under control, make sure there's no opposition, and then externally, you know, be willing to do assassination and liquidate enemies and all this kind of stuff. And we thought, hey, you know, if they're willing to do that, we're going to fall behind. And so I think in those early years, working with the British mostly, there was this thought that we had to play those same games. And so a lot of those early years in the 40s and 50s, we were involved in sort of a lot of that whole game of subversion, disinformation, you know, overthrowing countries, engaging in election interference. I think as the years went by, we learned several things. We learned that the unintended consequences sometimes seems like great. You won the election in Italy or Iran, what have you. But it came back to haunt us. And separately, we can't hold secrets the same way those people do. Things come out at some point. You know, we have oversight. It gets into Congress. You know, we can keep certain secrets, but those big kind of things will come out. And then eventually what seemed like a good idea suddenly isn't an idea. So that kind of thing that we used to do, we hold the right to do that as if our presidents and our congressmen people think that it's critical for our national safety, but by no means are we sort of trying to operate like them and do the same kind of things that people who don't have rule of law do.
And anytime I think of the CIA, the things that come up are, I think of obviously Iran, Chile, those countries. And but I think you bring up something interesting in that the creation of the CIA and the activities that they participate in, it's all within the context of the Soviet Union's existence. And I think a lot of people forget of just how big of a challenge and how big of a real enemy the Soviet Union was. Now, not saying about, I don't know enough about CIA activities to be able to, you know, really go into it and you know, call you out as a representative or anything like that. But I think a lot of people do forget of just how powerful the Soviet Union was and how much of a threat it was, and how that colored a lot of it.
Absolutely. I mean, in the early years after the war, you know, the Soviets had a massive, massive army, and they had the atomic bomb. And yet we forget, though, but in those years, we didn't have insight. We didn't have spies inside. We didn't have satellites, so we had no idea what they were doing. We originally started to get U-2 planes and things to go over Russia to try to figure out how much they had, where were they. So in the early years, like in Berlin, we didn't even know where they were massing or where they had troops. And so there was a hair trigger where we thought World War III or atomic war could start at any time. And, you know, and so in that milieu, I think people were willing to push and do a lot of things that we don't have a need to do or feel that we're under that kind of threat anymore. Yeah. And also, like I said, those early years, I think a lot of that stuff backfired. I don't think it, you know, what happened in Chile. And another thing to remember is, and it's okay, you know, the CIA's job is to do some of those deniable things, but those things are all done on behalf of presidents and administrations. Like the CIA didn't make up any, like there's no activity that we decide we want to do without being pushed by a president. In fact, nowadays to do anything, it's called covert action. You have to have a presidential written finding to say what activity the CIA should get involved in. And so it's sort of funny, if you're in the CIA, they'll talk about, you know, the CIA overthrow in Iran or the CIA activity here and there, but nobody ever says the Department of Defense invasion of Iraq or the Department of Defense like it's the U.S. We work for presidents and administrations, and it's U.S. policy to do those things. If some of them are done secretly, it's not that the CIA did it on its own. It was that it was ordered to do so.
Is it true that we don't spy or operate only with enemies, but we do it with friends as well?
Depends what you mean by friends. There's that old statement.
Well, we all remember
friends
that,
and
Yeah, we all remember the Israeli spy here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. or spying in the U.S., which was a horrible thing to do. But, you know.
Jonathan Pollard.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I'm sure we have some, say, spies in, like, maybe Saudi Arabia, maybe, like, people that we have interest with and allies, but at the same time, things can change quickly.
Yeah, so there's allies that we do a tremendous amount of work with. I mean, people talk about it for CIA. I would say 75 to 80% of the intelligence that the CIA creates and distributes and disseminates to policymakers in the United States comes from cooperation with foreign services and some allies and some not. We work with some countries that we're not allied with otherwise that provide incredible help to us on a lot of things, on terrorism, on areas of mutual concern. So we get, you know, most of our intelligence from working with foreign countries and friends. But in terms of allies and things, there's some places where, yes, we work with them, we consider them friends for the most part, but there is stuff that they do for their own purposes that they hide from us that we believe that is still necessary to understand. Like, look at Germany. There was a few years ago the story that we were looking at Merkel's phone and we were spying in Germany and people were like, oh my goodness. Now, of course, the Germans were doing the same thing in the United States and spying on the White House, and that's come out publicly. But there's stuff where the Germans did, the German Al-Qaeda group that did 9/11 were in Germany. And we knew they were there and trying to track them, and they were embarrassed by it and not sharing some of that stuff with us. So there's times when, even though we're friends, there's stuff that we believe we need to know, and we do know, that they're not sharing with us. And we, you know, we, as a country, we make a determination that we need to know that. But in general, you know, most spying is on countries that are considered, you know, potential threats to us or not allies. But sometimes you sit on the edge there, there's things that are of interest that we're going to maintain a right to look at.
There's almost no morality to it, right? I mean if we need it, we need it. I mean, even torture, the people who object to torture, they try to object on moral reasons. But if it worked and we needed it, I imagine we would do it if we really needed it, if there was a, you know, a ticking time bomb, as they say. Or
yeah, it's a tough one because, again, it goes back to my other thing is, you know, there is a probably larger benefit to being seen as a country that doesn't torture people. But that whole debate has become oversimplified. There's sort of this view that, you know, there's a clear line of what's torture and what's not, and torture doesn't work, and therefore it's evil. And anyone who's stuck in this business and has been given the law about how far you can go and is held responsible to make sure that there's no terrorist attacks are going to try to push up against that line to do the best they can to collect intelligence and information for us. So it is a much more nuanced issue, but I understand the point, and you know, we as a country have never really had a debate is what exactly are we willing to put up with? What exactly is torture? What exactly are we going to decide to do? Because a lot, even after the stuff came out and there was a lot of push and it was, you know, administration said we won't do this and it's considered torture, there's still people in the government would say, well, but you know, in this case, you know, you guys would do the right thing and do it. And we'd be like, well, no, because, you know, we were doing what we thought was the right thing. And under the law, as you told it to us, and we got punished for it. So yeah, no, we're not going to do it next time, even if you think it's the right thing. So, I mean, it really is, the onus is on lawmakers to take their job seriously and write laws and policies and things clearly, rather than just leave the intelligence officers out there and, you know,
I can prove
praise them when it works and screw them if it becomes public.
I can prove that torture works. This is my proof.
Yeah, I work there. I work in
the know. This is my proof. I know that if I were tortured, I would sing like a bird, and I know I cannot be the only one. So, I mean, I've always thought that was very, very simplistic. I imagine in any torture situation, you have three possible outcomes. They crack and they tell you what you want to know. They make it up and try to get away with lying to you, or they hold out. They have, you know, but and that splits according to certain probabilities, and
But the idea that people can say it doesn't work, nobody would ever tell a secret. They'll only tell a secret if you offer them cash or if you offer them a hot chick. Then they'll turn against their country. But they would never turn against their country if you're torturing the shit out of them. I mean, it's so not serious the way they talk about it. We end up not ever really having a serious conversation about torture. I mean, we know that people will turn against their country for much less reason than physical pain. So of course some people will turn against their country with physical pain. I'm not advocating.
It's not even turning against the country. This is only, you know, relates to terrorism and the notion that, you know, there's information about, you know, saving lives in the short term of a terrorist attack. Yeah. And for the most part, yeah, you know, as I explained, our job is to try to befriend people and gain trust with people so that they willingly give us stuff that benefits them, either for money or help with the kids or because they just want to do damage to a corrupt country. So the people that got into this program where we tried that and it didn't work, but we still believed that they had information about, you know, a bomb going to go off or an attack or a nuclear effort, then the decision was to ramp up the pressure. And that program was shared with the Justice Department and the White House, who all said, yes, this is legal. And then, of course, after the fact, people said it was torture. Now, I mean, at the end of the day, this they call it waterboarding, this torture, where you put people down and put a thing on their face. I never was involved in that. I don't know about it. But there's only three people that were ever waterboarded. It isn't as if there's like a whole bunch of people out there randomly trying to hurt people and torture people. It was a program that they decided there was three people that had information and they weren't sharing by basic means. And the view was they had access to tremendous stuff and Americans could die. And they decided to then, you know, use waterboarding, which had been approved by the Justice Department and the White House. And so, yes, in retrospect, I think I would say now it's torture too and we shouldn't do it. But it wasn't as if there's people who are looking to, you know, there's sadists who are trying to do damage to people. This was a program to try to get intelligence, and it did work.
Well, let me ask you so about that. First of all, it's one of those things that is so easy to judge if you're not responsible for protecting the lives of Americans. But I would say that only the president should be able to authorize it, and then at some point it should become public so he'd be accountable. But to me, I always thought, well, if the president can order a drone strike of some family in their tent willy-nilly and we're ready to accept that, and we don't even, and it doesn't even make, it's not even front page news when we find out about it, then why are we freaking out about a president waterboarding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Like why? I don't understand. Like once we're ready to trust a president with the authority to unilaterally just kill people in tents, the idea that he might waterboard one of the top terrorists in the world doesn't seem to me to be the priority issue at that point. I mean, he can do so much. If the president is a monster, I mean, he can fulfill all his whims perfectly legally, you know. Why would he torture somebody sadistically? So,
but no, I think the issue with that is that you do have voices saying, oh no, you shouldn't be able to do any of that shit. Where you do have people who've sort of like let the ruler, do what he wants willy nilly, whether it's, you know, droning a wedding in Yemen. There are people saying like, no, hold on, but we're not for any of that.
You're
right.
One thing with Sheikh Mohammed, Khalid bin whatever his name, I forgot.
Sheikh Mohammed.
How do you forget your uncle's name? That's crazy.
Named Mohammed.
we haven't talked for a while.
Oh, hold on, before I have to cut that out. That's a joke that we tell between.
We're not getting.
Not him. So, it goes back, has a long history. Okay, go ahead.
Send
your letters to Hatem. He told the joke first. Go ahead.
They torture him and they gave him wrong information, and based on that information they attacked civilians and a lot of civilians died. That was the we had a lawyer from Guantanamo Bay, you remember, Norman, you told us stuff like that. So not torture, not sometimes he can just give you any information and based on that innocent people die. That's why this is sometimes it doesn't work.
Yeah.
John, what do you think?
No, I mean, anyone who gets involved in this stuff, it's the debates are simplified, but the people who are involved in it try to take it seriously. And again, no, even when you talk about drones and taking out a wedding or something, there is no one I know in U.S. government that would willingly kill civilians or in a, you know, a wedding if they knew that's what it was. I think there has been mistakes where they thought they had somebody and didn't do that. I mean, if a president ordered that, there would be people both in the military and CIA that would say no. I mean, there are, you know, we are pushed to talk about, you know, if you're going to be involved in this business, you better have a good sense of where the line is legally, ethically, and morally. And you've got to be comfortable with yourself of when you're going to say yes and when you're going to say no.
But I think there must be some few bad apples in the CIA that they send them to special locations and like, oh, we know this guy is going to take care of business.
No, not really. And in fact, you know, those people, you know, end up getting kicked out or you know, even prosecuted. Because the business, it's too serious. And because the laws are made to give us incredible latitude overseas, like I said, the FBI are like cops but the CIA are like robbers. Our job is to break the law overseas. Espionage and stealing is illegal in every country. And we're doing it because it's in the interest of the United States government. It's not because it's fun. It's not because we like hurting people. Mm. It's because our country, with congressional oversight and administrations and you know, legal input, is considered critical for our national safety. And so people take that really seriously. And therefore, when you're operating on the edge along the sidelines, sometimes people step over and that has to be dealt with and people have to be held accountable. But also, I think most American citizens expect us to be dealing up to the edge where the law is in order to keep people safe. And so everybody I know takes that really seriously. And I don't know anybody who's looking to hurt or torture people or do anything, you know, for reasons other than they believe it's in the benefit of the American people.
I think there's a terrible, like, I know Lou probably agrees, there's a kind of terrible cognitive bias that we always suffer from, which is that the more you're concerned about something, actually, in a sense, the higher your moral principles are, the more you see that you're falling short, the more you focus on it, and then the more it appears that you're bad, like on racism, for instance. There was a heat map in the Washington, on the Rolling Stone, was it? I don't know, where they talked about, you know, they showed all the countries, and they used one poll question. How many of you would not like to live next door to somebody of a different race? And all through Asia and Africa and everything was like, nobody wanted to live next to somebody of a different race. And in those countries, you know, they don't have a racism problem, right? Because they don't think that way. We're very, very concerned with racism in this country, rightfully so. So then we manage to see it because we can't put it in perspective, you know, and we beat ourselves over the head with it. And again, rightfully so. And I think it's the same thing with our foreign shenanigans. We're probably, I hope, among the most moral foreign actors. And that's why anytime we do something, like you said, they told it was okay. And then the justice, what kind of country reassesses a Justice Department rule about waterboarding and then punishes retroactively or talks about punishing retroactively the people who had permission to torture the greatest enemy that country had ever had? You know, I mean, like, it's really a sign of our goodness. I mean, I don't want to sound like a waving the flag, but I think it really, if you look at it from a certain point of view, it really shows something we should be proud of in America, that we even have these conversations and worry about them so sincerely. I don't think in Russia they're giving 2 seconds thought to anything.
we will go and say, this is FDA approved at the water porting.
I just want to piggyback what you were talking about, Noam, just on the foreign policy. So me, I'm a libertarian. I'm, you know, a small L libertarian. And for the most part, libertarians are anti-war, non-interventionists, right? And for a long time, I think that sort of blinded me to world events, in that I didn't want to be anywhere in the world if we're at war. I don't want it at all. But, you know, if going back to whether it's 2008, 2012, or, you know, coming up, you know, 2020, whoever is elected is given the world as it is. We have bases in all these other countries. There are all these conflicts going on, right? It's very easy for me as a libertarian who will not be in power to say, well, just pull them out. And it was, for longtime listeners of Live from America, I would say go back to the episode that we did with was one of the journalists who was talking about Syria. And I had no idea that because of, it could be argued that because of a lack of action on the part of Barack Obama, that maybe 500,000 Syrians died. So, you know, these are, actions have consequences and lack of action also has consequences. So it's something that I've had to definitely wrestle with my, with my philosophy and,
worldview.
And all that on these. And I think a similar thing comes with the CIA. I'm gonna get so many of my anarchist and libertarian friends come at me for this, but I think it's I'm expressing some humility, I think, on this subject.
Well, I don't do that, Lou, but I agree with you. No. I mean, of course, you're right. Everybody should be humble. I mean, no ideology. And anybody, ideologues really need to have more humility in general, because there is no ideology which works across the board. Everything reaches its limiting points that you know, whatever, you understand.
Well, I do think one of the things that I liked about working the CIA, and I think makes it hard to deal with some of these issues that become public, is anywhere you go and the deeper you dig into culture and issue, the more you learn, the less clear it becomes that there's a right, wrong, and you know, as you pull off those layers, you realize there's so much more there about, you know, about peoples and cultures and what's important and how they view their histories and, you know, what's right and wrong. And so that's why it hurts them to come back, and you see leadership sometimes in the United States or other places simplifying things to a point which doesn't make sense for what you're seeing. And so a lot of times you see it with Trump, they don't like CIA people because we're offering them information that's nuanced and difficult. We're not giving them answers that just solve their problems. Like, you know, this is bad. Tell us it's true. Well, actually it's very complicated, sir. Here's what's really happening. And leadership, they often want they want us to just support whatever their policy and personal political views are. And we can't do that because the world is a complicated place. And the more you learn about things, the less that, you know, there's just a right and wrong answer. And so I like that because I like living overseas. I like dealing with cultures. I like digging into these things and dealing with them.
Do you think it's tough with this administration in particular because of, you know, charges of the deep state being sort of having like, you know, him in their sight lines?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult because, you know, I worked for almost 30 years. And so I think I worked under the Reagan administration and then Bush and then Clinton and obviously Clinton and Obama before I retired. And essentially the work was pretty much the same. I mean, everybody I worked with, we thought we were involved in national security. We're trying to protect American people. Different presidents, different parties would come in, and essentially we were doing what we thought we needed to do. It wasn't as if, you know, I worked with friends in really tough places around the world for like 30 years, and I had no idea what their politics were, and they didn't know what mine were. Like, we didn't talk about presidents and political parties. And it wasn't until I retired and I see some of my friends on Facebook, and I'm like, holy shit, I didn't know he was a right-wing nut or a left-wing. And we take that really seriously. We're not partisan. We support the United States. We take an oath to the Constitution. We try to provide presidents, whatever president is, with the best intelligence you can get. And so it really hurts when somebody comes in and a president and says, oh, you guys are all about, you know, you're Obama's CIA. And they're telling people out through the country that these institutions, FBI, CIA, military, others, are essentially just tools of political parties. And that's really damaging. I mean, the American people need to understand that, you know, most of these institutions are working on their behalf. We're not partisan. It's not, you know, we don't just jerk back and forth for whatever party's in power. Again, these things are much more complicated and difficult to work. And so, yeah, it hurts when he does those things and says those things, because essentially it's ripping that relationship between the American people and the institutions. And people lose trust in their government. And there's places that are worth losing trust in and voting new people in and out. But if you believe that the vast majority of public servants are actually working against you, then we're in a bad place for the country.
If there's an American spy got caught, okay, and another spy that you recruited that's not an American citizen, how far would you go for both to save, like policy-wise, if you can talk about it?
So everything that we do, again, I'm in the clandestine service, the espionage side of the agency. I'm trying to recruit foreigners in places to give us access to information we need. And I'm trying to keep them safe. So I want them to be there for years and years. And when I leave, I want to be able to turn that relationship over to my replacement, continue that relationship. So that spy and name your place in China is working for us for years and years and giving us insight that, you know, we really feel like we need. So we really take that relationship serious. Keeping that person safe is what it's all about to us. And so, you know, if he gets caught,
would you negotiate it for him or no? Like, I know the policy for American citizen, you would.
We would try, if we had any sense they were about to get caught, we would try to get them out, to try to save them. If they're caught, we would try to either negotiate to get them out or break them out. It depends on the country and what we're able to do. But yeah, what we can't do is lose faith with people like that. We won't be able to recruit anybody else if it looks like we just throw people away. It's like you see movies with law enforcement and they talk about snitches and they talk about, you know, people who are just helping, giving them information, and then they toss them aside. You know, if you're in this business as a professional and doing this, that doesn't work. You need, if you make a commitment to someone to keep them safe and their family safe, you have to stick with that and take it very seriously. If it looks like you don't actually have faith with these people and trust them, no one's going to work for you. So to us, that's a big deal. We do amazing things, spend lots of money, time, effort, put ourselves in harm's way to protect those sources that work for us.
I have to leave you guys. Wow, this was terrific. I'm happy to meet you. Maybe you come on again, but I got a virtual appointment I have to accept.
No worries. Pleasure to meet you.
If my wife were better at technology, I could spare a few more minutes, but I think I can't. So
always blame the wife. So John, I want to talk about double agents. We saw that like a lot in movies, like somebody right. who works for government and then you turn him to be another, you know, does that really happen?
So yeah, some different definitions for us here. We consider ourselves, like I work for a CIA officer, mm-hmm. the person, the Russian, Chinese, Iranian, whatever, who works for me, that's our agent, our source. Okay. And the FBI, they call their officers agents. So it ends up being confusing people. Uh-huh. A double agent is essentially a tool that's used. So the person who's spying for us is our agent. A double agent would be, for example, if we're trying to figure out what the Russians are trying to find out about the United States, about, I don't know, FBI, we might take someone like you, for example, have them and prepare you and put you out there sort of as bait for the Russians or somebody to meet, you know, and you would tell them, like, you know, you're upset about your boss or your job or you don't like your country. And so they would recruit you as a spy, mm-hmm. and you would be their agent. You'd be spying for them, but really you wouldn't be, because you'd still be reporting back to us. So you'd be pretending like that's what we call a double agent. So like,
how do you trust them that they actually doing what they're supposed to do?
Well, it's a business, a professional business. You have to do a lot. You have to pick the right people. You have to really test them, polygraph them, put them through security, understand them, understand what makes them tick, train them so they're not put in dangerous positions. The military does this a lot, and so they'll train people, and oftentimes they will give people that don't have access. Like, in general, you wouldn't want to give someone who has the access to the most biggest secret and then dangle them out there as your double agent, because there's a chance he actually could give up your deepest secret. So you put people who, you know,
yeah,
that makes sense. I would, you know, before you'd go meet the Russian, we'd prepare you for what stuff you should tell him and what not tell him and things. And to make it look real, you might give him some real stuff and this and that, but our goal would be then to debrief you afterwards and find out, hey, what is it the Russians are asking for? What do they know? Because you can learn a lot from their questions, because if they're asking a lot of questions about a program that we thought they didn't know about, it would be like, huh, that's interesting. How do they know that? And we can start mm-hmm. investigating to figure out why is that less secure than we thought. So that's what we call double agents.
So it's a different term. Obviously, you know, everyone is, I think, interested in sort of the glamour, the Hollywood glamour of, you know, espionage and that sort of thing. But I think other people would also be interested in, you know, conspiracy theories. And, you know, you, I don't think there's one conspiracy theory that doesn't involve some CIA agent or former CIA agent. So number one, how do you prove that the person who says they were CIA is actually CIA? Because they're, when it comes to, say, like Navy SEALs, you have quite a few people who go around with, you know, and doing stolen valor, impersonating Navy SEALs. Right. And when questioned on it, they say, oh, well, it was classified. And fortunately, with Navy SEALs, no, their name would be in their graduating class. Is there a similar thing with CIA? Because whether it's 9/11 or the assassination of JFK or UFOs, there's always a person interviewed who is former CIA. So I'm wondering, you know, how do you?
That's a good question. And there isn't. And in our business, again, unlike FBI, if the FBI comes in, show they have a badge and they say what they're doing. When we work overseas, even when we're developing relations with people and we eventually tell them we're working for the CIA, I don't have a, you know, essentially it has to be, I've built that trust. You actually believe what I'm saying and I'm able to come through for you. So yeah, that, and there are people who are out there pretending to be CIA. My advice would be try to find some people that you're pretty confident that have a public persona that you could, that are in touch with other very senior CIA people. And then if you're having questions about them, feel free to bring it to people like me or others. And we can, because there's people I see out there and I'm like, that's bullshit. That guy doesn't. Hmm. And I'm the same with the Navy SEALs. I'm sure they watch those guys. They're like, oh, no. That's, you know. Now, it's interesting. It is illegal to impersonate a U.S. military officer. It's not illegal to impersonate a CIA officer. And so a lot of times there's nothing we can do legally when people are, and there's people overseas that do it too, that go to talk to foreigners and pretend they're CIA people. And it's dangerous. But getting back to the glamour thing, I would say it's glamorous in the sense that it's you're working on important issues and it's fun and you're traveling around the world. It's not cars and shooting and all that kind of glamour, more bureaucratic. At the end of the day, all of these things that we're doing, you have to write it all up. So you're spending a lot of time writing and crafting and sending in things and reading. And so it's bureaucratic. And then the other one is a conspiracy thing. Anyone who's involved in actually trying to create conspiracy. So in some sense, what our job is to convince the other side, to convince other security services that we're not working against them and try to hide what we're doing and maybe come up with a way to sort of fool them about what we're up to. So we're essentially almost in some ways in the creation of conspiracy business to the other side. But anyone who's in that profession realizes it's amazingly hard to try to come up with anything complicated and nuanced and complex. It just doesn't, it'll fall apart. People know about it. And so there are probably actual people who worked in CIA and intelligence are probably the least likely to believe conspiracy theories, because you realize there's no way people could have pulled off the shit that, you know, they're saying. So people come with these conspiracy theories and they're like, there's no way you could do that, knowing exactly that this person would act that way and this person would act that way and nobody would talk. And, you know, like the Kennedy assassination, all these, like all that stuff, you could go years and years and nobody would talk. Come on. So yeah, we're not the type that fall into believing conspiracy theories in general.
Speaking of no glamour, let's talk about your Hollywood show, Spy Wars.
Let's finally plug it.
Yeah, Spy Wars. So tell us how involved are you in it? And I know you've been in a couple of episodes as well.
In a couple of episodes to talk. They did a series of stories of real spy operations with the British and Israelis and others and us. And I worked in Moscow and then in our Russia program for years and was involved in the arrest of FBI Special Agent Robert Hansen, among other things. And so they interviewed me for some of those things. And so I was interviewed in it and it was fun, but it wasn't my program. But interestingly, in the last couple of years, I worked with another CIA recently retired officer of 30 some years who had was a chief of station in Germany and Iraq and Philippines and around the world. And we've created a company called Spycraft Entertainment. And we're working with Hollywood to create shows, movies, streaming series, espionage content. And we have a number of sort of programs moving forward, and that we've optioned a number of books of spy stories. We've done some of our own. We're working with a number. Like I told you, we have this show with Apple, a kid's show. We're working on a show with 20th Century Fox. We're working, we have a movie with Reed Morano as a director and Zoe Saldana as an actress in it that we're working on and stuff. And so, yeah, it's fun to be in that space and sort of work with, you know, really good writers and people who are interested in sort of, so we want to tell spy stories that are less about action and, you know, and make them more about sort of the human factor and the kind of things we talked about today.
No, interesting. I have an idea. We can do a show together. I want to do a show about the stupidest, like intelligence operations ever. Like the one with the Saudi Arabian embassy, for example. Like, did you see anything dumber than that?
Which one?
The one in the Turkey embassy when they killed the...
Oh, my God.
Like, that was... my opinion. I don't know. Is there anything more stupid than that?
Yeah, there's probably things more stupid than that. That's why your show is a good idea, because there's probably lots of crazy and stupid things that could come up. But do you remember when that was the Iranians tried to recruit a Mexican drug person to do an assassination in Washington? That was a couple of years ago. Fell apart. That's a dumb one. But yeah, yes, I think there is a show there, and I'd be glad to offline work with you on that.
That's great. Lu Yan?
Yeah, I'm in for any gig. I can just imagine. I think the future is really bright on the entertainment side for stories that revolve around espionage and all that. I wonder if the real world espionage is going to be hurt by the fact that you have, you know, a whole generation of people coming up whose entire lives are online. Whether it's them purposefully putting stuff out there on Instagram and all the other stuff, Snapchat, TikTok, or basically their life's worth of data is there for the taking.
That's right.
You know, the ability to find, the chances of you finding someone who can just shut up or not be on their phone, I think is pretty it's pretty difficult. I wonder
there's upsides in that. Like I said before, is it's easier for us to prepare to go after targets because we can dig into their social media and their lives much more online, so that when we know who to go after as opposed to sort of randomly looking for people. But yeah, I mean, think about, you know, one of the things that I liked about working in the CIA is when you went to a new country, you had to learn your way, right? You had to know every street, back alley. You had to be able to sort of maneuver through that city so that you understood if you were under surveillance, like, you know, where were they? How could you manipulate them if you were driving to make sure you were free of them or could get away from surveillance? You have to have this knowledge of spatial awareness of where you are and where surveillance might be and understand cities. We have a generation of people who grew up that now they just put their addresses in the phone. Like I have my kids, they can't even drive around the block without having their thing on telling them where to go.
I'm guilty. Guilty of that. And what's funny is, you know, every now and then the GPS will mess up and basically put you in a loop. And rather than me try to figure out a way to actually, you know, do it with my own eyes, I just keep following it and complaining until, you know, with the hope that, oh, it'll get me back to where I actually want to go.
Go ahead. I'll just say, in electronics, you're dangerous too, because like I said, our goal is to keep the people who work with us safe, and not just safe for tomorrow, but safe forever. And as long, the more data and electronic stuff you put out there, if I'm ever on phone with these people, or if it can be seen by my phone where I've been, and a foreign security service can put together where I've been and who I'm even meeting, they may come across and figure out who my sources are. Mm-hmm. And so that's dangerous for me. In fact, it's almost better in our world to get rid of all of that, to not carry a phone, not to carry electronics, not to be in touch with people, not to have electronic contact with them. I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, sexy stuff you can do online with encryption and hidden stuff. And that's cool. But at the end of the day, it's better if I met you and I talked to you and I leave and there's no record anywhere that you and I came together.
Yeah. There is a conspiracy theory. Obviously, I'm sure you heard about it, that Facebook and TikTok is all like Chinese intelligence, U.S. intelligence. That would be great. I mean, if it was, but you know, do you think because I know the TikTok doesn't have, you don't have to protect your information. Like Facebook, they say they do, you know, But TikTok, they say they don't. They can share the information, they can do whatever they want. You know, so do you think that this could be a Chinese or involved in it at all?
Yes. And I say that even if it wasn't built to be a Chinese espionage thing, that's fine. By law, Chinese companies have to turn over whatever the government asks. I mean, there's no question. It's part of the law. They come to you and say, now, if CIA or the FBI goes to Google or goes to Apple and says, we want this information, there has to be a predicated, legal document asking for this. Like, and so they can say, screw off, unless there's...
I remember Apple didn't want to do the terrorist phone.
No, exactly. Yeah. And so, I mean, again, that's in the bigger picture, that's good for us. We want a country where government just can't tell everybody what to do. And it's a good sign to the rest of the world. And that's why people look up to America. But it does make the job of places like the FBI and those harder. But in China and in Russia, they have access to all of that. And so, there's so many billions of things that obviously they can't track and be on top of all of it. But if they choose to ask for, I want everything on Hotman, they'll get it. No questions asked.
Thanks. I'm probably gonna have to leave you guys in a little
bit. We're actually gonna wrap up. It's been an hour.
Okay, yeah, but I just want to wrap up with just one question about in regards to China. And I know that at some universities in Australia, the Chinese government has been accused of sort of embedding agents who are Chinese nationals into programs that research programs and that sort of thing. And I've seen that same charge being made at American universities, which I think opens up a can of worms about immigration and national security and all that stuff. Do you have any insights on that?
Yes, the Chinese intelligence services, yes, they try to put people in all these places. They have a large population. They have an interest in all of these programs. They're much more interested than the U.S. is in general in stealing intellectual property and these type of things. And so, for the most part, my job is looking for national security, like what is their military doing? What are the terrorists doing? That type of stuff. When I'm overseas, I'm not looking to like, what is this French company doing? Or what is this China? Like, that's just not the kind of things that we're asked to try to get overseas. But the Chinese and others are asked to steal. Much of in the Soviet Union, almost everything in their military was based on stolen stuff from the West and from the United States, to include the atomic program. And the Chinese are very interested in stealing Western technology. And so, yes, they put people in all these places. Now, in terms of, it's tough because in terms of immigration, you don't want to say, then we shouldn't have Chinese people in our universities. That's just, it's not the majority of people doing it. So that makes it very difficult. And we need to sort of really invest in, Homeland Security and the FBI and people who really look at these things so that we can do it the best we can of defending against, deterring and uncovering real things like that. But also making sure that we're not, turning away, legitimate, researchers and students, because we benefit by that as a country.
Last question, your two parts, your favorite spy movie or show and projects you're working on coming up soon.
Okay. So I have a friend coming, so I'll go quick. I like the Americans with the Russian.
Oh, that's a great
illegals
show.
And stuff. Now, I mean, it's a lot more murder and stuff than in real life, but it does have that sort of feel of a kind of tradecraft and those kind of things. And yeah, we have a number of projects. We have a book called Betrayal in Berlin about the Berlin spy tunnel that the CIA built from West Berlin to East Berlin in the 1950s. We have one on the Glomar Explorer where the CIA in the 1960s created a undercover Howard Hughes project to go out into the Pacific Ocean and did from 3 miles under the water to pick up a Soviet submarine that had crashed, to get nuclear weapons from that thing. We have a show in Afghanistan. We have a show about, we have a number of sort of character-driven sort of shows that we're pushing forward. We have one about sort of a Nazi in Hawaii in the lead up to Pearl Harbor, a true story that we're working on with Gidi Roth, the guy who did the original Homeland and did Spy with Sacha Baron Cohen. We're working on Spy 2 with him. So a number of different shows. It's fun. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So do you want to share your contact information or people want to follow you or check out your work?
I'm on Twitter under my real name. And my company is called Spycraft Entertainment. And you can write to me at john@spycraftentertainment.com. And that's
me. John, it was really great to have you. We'd love to have you back again. And if you come to New York City, you should come to the Comedy Cellar. You
know, yeah, that'd be fun. Hang out with us.
Yeah. Lou, do you want to share your information?
Yeah, you can follow me at the Lou Perez on all social media platforms.
And it's live from America Podcast. And John, it was really, really nice to meet you finally. And we'll be in touch. We're working the show. Oops. It's called Oops.
Yeah. Oh, I like it. I really appreciate it. It's a real pleasure to talk to you guys. A lot of fun.
Thank you. Have a good one. Thanks. Take care. Stay safe.
Yep, you too.